one-man revolution, a guerrilla scholar warrior, a renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
Welcome to the Dangerous History Podcast. I am your intrepid history host, Prof. CJ, doing my best to tell you the stories that the man, if there actually were such a real person, would rather you not know. First off, just want to wish a happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. If you are an American, if you're one of my listeners from other countries, still all the best to you and yours. I know other countries have Thanksgiving type things sometimes on different weeks or months than the American one, which is usually the fourth Thursday in November, looking at it coming up in a few days. And in my little corner of the world, which is one particular corner of the region known as the Sun Belt, we've just had our first real cool fall feeling days last week. Now it's warming back up. I'm hoping it'll cool off once again as Thanksgiving gets closer. But anyway, in light of the season, I thought I'd tell you a history story that I've been thinking about doing a podcast on for a while now, and it seemed appropriate given the approach of Thanksgiving to do sort of a Dangerous History Podcast Thanksgiving special. Tell you some history stuff that, while not directly related to Thanksgiving itself, has to do with those pilgrims and shows you some of the darker sides of them. One of my heroes, the great 20th century writer H.L. Mencken, once defined Puritanism as the haunting fear that someone, somewhere, may be happy. The Puritans played an important role, I think tragically, in the founding of what eventually became the United States. And a lot of things can be found from their legacy to the present day, as far as the desire of some people to impose their morality upon others, even when nobody's life, liberty, or property are being harmed by whatever behavior or items are being sought to be banned by those with the vestigial mindset of the Puritans. Now, in 1620, a group from England of religious dissidents known as Pilgrims came on the Mayflower and founded a colony called Plymouth at Massachusetts Bay. Now, the difference between Pilgrims and Puritans is one that confounds a lot of people. Very often, the terms are used interchangeably, and I think a lot of people are just not quite sure what the difference is. And I'll do my best to clear that up here. All Pilgrims are Puritans, but not all Puritans are Pilgrims. Technically, both Pilgrims and Puritans are types of Puritans. So in other words, Pilgrims are a specific subset of the larger group of Puritans. And the difference, what makes the Pilgrims distinct from other Puritans, has very little to do with theological beliefs or anything like that. As far as I'm aware, and I don't claim to be the world's greatest expert, their theological beliefs between the Puritans and other Pilgrims are almost identical. But it's a disagreement over tactics. The Pilgrims were Puritans who wanted to separate. They were separatists. They wanted to separate from the Church of England, whereas the Puritans tried, at least initially, to purify the Church of England from within. So these groups share beliefs. They just disagree over tactics. They both agree that the Church of England, as it existed in the early 17th century, was very flawed at best. And it was just a disagreement over whether the correct way to go about fixing that was to separate or try and fix it from inside. So the Pilgrims founded this colony in Marymount, and just a few years later, actually in 1625, just up the road, a guy named Thomas Morton organized a non-Puritan settlement that became known as Marymount, just north of Plymouth, just down the road. The present-day site, by the way, is Quincy, Massachusetts. Now, Morton came from a place called Devon in southwest England, which was a very non-Puritan part of England. And for more on the different origins of the various peoples who came to the early British North American colonies, the best place to start by far, it's a massive book, but I mean, it's very well done. The research is incredible, is a book called Albion Seed, by David Hackett Fisher, top-notch American historian of colonial America. The Puritans came primarily from eastern England, from sort of East Anglia, the towns there. Southern and southwestern England were not Puritan. They tended to be more hotbeds of what was called High Church Anglicanism, which is a form of Church of England that is very similar to old style Catholicism and also still contains a lot of pagan practices. Now you have to understand that, like H.L. Mencken's quote indicates, the Puritans tended to believe that just about anything that was enjoyable was evil. Even things that might on the face of them look relatively wholesome, the Puritans would have a tendency to see them as evil simply if they were enjoyable. And you can see this personified when they set up rules in their own colonies. You can also see it when, in the mid-17th century, the Puritans win the English Civil War, and for about a decade, they rule England. Even though the majority of the people in England were actually not Puritans, but the Puritans managed to grab a hold of the government and the military of the time due to the Civil War. And when the Puritans were in charge in England, they tried to ban all sorts of things that they saw as potentially evil. In particular, they disliked anything that to them reminded them of Catholicism or of paganism, which in their minds were almost the same thing anyway. So when the Puritans were in charge of England in the mid-17th century, they destroyed a lot of beautiful old churches that had been around since medieval times. They thought stained glass was evil. They thought decorative sculptures in a church were evil. Basically, Puritans thought churches needed to be as bland, as drab, and preferably uncomfortable as possible. Also, when the Puritans were in charge briefly in England, they tried to ban Christmas. As you can imagine, that didn't go over too well. They saw Christmas as not being a true Christian holiday. They saw it as being too Catholic and too pagan, which, I mean, historically speaking, they're kind of right, but anything that was fun, the Puritans saw as evil. When the Puritans were in charge in England for a while in the mid-17th century, they even shut down plays, playhouses, because people might actually go to a play and enjoy themselves. So clearly it's a diversion. Puritans are of the mindset that God really doesn't want you to be terribly comfortable or happy, and that, you ought to spend all your time working and praying and that sort of stuff, and that relaxing, having a good time, any sort of leisure activity, these are all tools of the devil. So here comes Thomas Morton from southwestern England, from this high church Anglicanism slash paganism region. And in many ways, his colony ended up being the opposite of everything that the Pilgrims and Puritans stood for. Historian Thaddeus Russell in A Renegade History of the United States has, I think, a page or two on this. He writes, quote, "Whiskey and beer flowed freely, and whites and Indians cavorted, copulated, and danced wildly around a maypole, a pagan invention that had become the symbol of fun and leisure in villages across England," end quote. So in other words, the non-Puritans, these semi-pagan people who went to Marymount, they got along relatively well with the local Indians. They drank, they partied, they had these great wild times dancing around fires and dancing around the maypole and all this good stuff. And in the first couple of years of its existence, Marymount started to have a population boom and started to grow at a faster rate than Plymouth's population. Gee, I can't imagine. You've got one colony where everything fun is illegal, where everybody's sort of dour all the time and dresses drably, and I mean everything from dancing to beautiful clothing and beautiful decorations are evil. And then you got a colony up the road where fun is embraced, leisure is embraced, having a good time, enjoying life, enjoying beauty, all these sorts of things are embraced. Gee, I can't imagine why the latter colony would be attracting a lot more immigrants than the dour Puritans down in Plymouth. Well, in 1628, the Pilgrims in Plymouth, according to Thaddeus Russell, quote, "dispatched Captain Miles Standish and an armed force to destroy their libertine competitors. Morton was nearly killed in the assault, then hauled into a Plymouth court and deported back to England. The maypole was chopped down and burned," end quote. And the following year, what was left of the colony of Marymount was destroyed by the Pilgrims, including their food. And shortly thereafter, Plymouth even cracked down on its own people. It was worried, I guess, about satanic influence spreading to them from the Marymount people, Plymouth authorities officially banned men and women from touching each other in any way while dancing. And as the area continued to be colonized, you had, you know, larger groups of Puritans, non-Pilgrim Puritans coming from 1630 onward. Many towns in Massachusetts Bay Area just banned dancing outright. So think about this. Here it is, one of the origins of America, of what will become, you know, the United States, one of the earliest British North American colonies. And on the one hand, you've got these people who think stained glass is evil, dancing is evil, Christmas is evil, any sort of party's evil, any sort of fun or leisure activity is evil. Not only that, but they think that they have a God-given right to impose their beliefs and preferences on others who may not even share them. And then on the other hand, you've got a place that's live and let live, laid back. I mean, they almost remind you of like fun-loving hippies when you hear about how much the Marymounters enjoyed themselves, were laid back, got along with the Indians, and not surprisingly, attracted a lot more immigrants into their colony. So what happened? We have this tension already in the 1620s. We have this tension that endures in America to this day between the Puritan mindset and its descendants versus the mindset of freedom, of live and let live, of if you're not harming some innocent person with your behavior, knock yourself out, even if it's something that some people might consider to be vice-ridden. Well, what really... I think costs the Marymounters their right to exist in their own free and independent colony and do things their way was that they were not prepared to fight back. They were victims, in a way, of their own laid-back attitude, I think. While the Pilgrims were always, you know, had their blunderbusses in close reach and were always quick to shoot at anybody who bothered them, Indians, Marymounters, whoever. The Marymount people were just laid back and fun-loving and perhaps should have spent a little more time training up some sort of little defense force. Perhaps if the Marymounters would have had a halfway decent little militia self-defense force, the Pilgrims in Plymouth would not have been able to march up there and shut them down and destroy their colony. This episode, I think, vindicates those great philosophers who once wisely entreated us that one has to fight for one's right to party. Of course, those philosophers being the Beastie Boys. So much that has ruined lives and made life unpleasant in America ever since has come from the legacy of the Puritan mindset, the Puritan attitude. Not just the attitude that anything that's a vice should be a crime, and that anything that's, you know, too fun should be illegal, but also the mindset that communities that have these sorts of beliefs are totally okay imposing those beliefs on other communities who don't share them. The notion that, you know, one group of religious people has the right to impose their preferences through force of law on other communities who may not be religious or who may have totally different religions that don't see certain activities as being wrong. Prohibition. Alcohol prohibition has its origins in the Puritan mindset. So does the modern-day war on drugs. So do laws against prostitution and gambling. So does all kinds of censorship laws and regulations. All these things are very conflicted attitudes about everything from sex to vices, substances, gambling. All of our weird, contradictory attitudes and taboos and laws that make no sense and make lives get destroyed by people being thrown into prison for, you know, harmless acts of, even if you consider these things unwise vices, should vices be crimes? That to me is a very important question that nobody ever wants to ask. Nathaniel Hawthorne, one of the greatest writers in American history, who's probably most famous for writing The Scarlet Letter and a bunch of other things, oftentimes set in early New England, author of one of my favorite short stories, Young Goodman Brown, also wrote a story about Marymount. It's called The Maypole of Marymount, and it was first published in the 1830s in Twice Told Tales. and vivid language. You know, here we have a guy in the 19th century writing about something sort of using the language of the 17th century, and it's beautiful prose. It's a little anachronistic for us today, obviously, but I think it's worth reading, and so I'm going to go to the trouble of reading you Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Maypole of Merrymount, so that you can get a sort of a vivid depiction of what this must have been like, this happy, fun-loving sort of a colony getting squashed by these dour Puritans looking to stamp out their lifestyle. The Maypole of Merrymount by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Bright were the days at Merrymount, when the maypole was the banner staff of that gay colony. They who reared it, should their banner be triumphant, were to pour sunshine over New England's rugged hills and scatter flower seeds throughout the soil. Jollity and gloom were contending for an empire. Midsummer Eve had come, bringing deep verdure to the forest and roses in her lap of a more vivid hue than the tender buds of spring. But May, or her mirthful spirit, dwelt all the year round at Merrymount, sporting with the summer months and reveling with autumn and basking in the glow of a winter's fireside. Through a world of toil and care, she flitted with a dreamlike smile, and came hither to find a home among the lightsome hearts of Merrymount. Never had the maypole been so gaily decked as at sunset on Midsummer Eve. This venerated emblem was a pine tree, which had preserved the slender grace of youth while it equaled the loftiest height of the old wood monarchs. From its top streamed a silken banner, colored like the rainbow. Down nearly to the ground, the pole was dressed with birchen boughs, and others of the liveliest green, and some with silvery leaves, fastened by ribbons that fluttered in fantastic knots, of 20 different colors, but no sad ones. Garden flowers and blossoms of the wilderness laughed gladly forth amid the verdure, so fresh and dewy that they must have grown by magic on that happy pine tree. Where this green and flowery splendor terminated, the shaft of the maypole was stained with the seven brilliant hues of the banner at its top. On the lowest green bough hung an abundant wreath of roses, some that had been gathered in the sunniest spots of the forest, and others of still richer blush, which the colonists had reared from English seed. O people of the Golden Age, the chief of your husbandry was to raise flowers. But what was the wild throng that stood hand in hand about the maypole? It could not be that the fauns and nymphs, when driven from their classic groves and homes of ancient fable, had sought refuge, as all the persecuted did, in the fresh woods of the West. These were Gothic monsters, though perhaps of Grecian ancestry. On the shoulders of a comely youth uprose the head and branching antlers of a stag. A second, human in all other points, had the grim visage of a wolf. A third, still with the trunk and limbs of a mortal man, showed the beard and horns of a venerable he-goat. There was the likeness of a bear erect, brute, in all but its hind legs, which were adorned with pink silk stockings. And here again, almost as wondrous, stood a real bear of the forest, of the dark forest, lending each of his forepaws to the grasp of a human head, and as ready for the dance as any in that circle. His inferior nature rose halfway to meet his companions as they stopped. Other faces wore the similitude of man or woman, but distorted or extravagant, with red noses, pendulous before their mouths, which seemed of awful depth, and stretched from ear to ear in an eternal fit of laughter. Here might be seen the salvage man, well known in heraldry, hairy as a baboon, and girdled with green leaves. By his side, a noble figure, but still a counterfeit, appeared an Indian hunter, with feathery crest and wampum belt. Many of this strange company wore fool's caps, and had little bells appended to their garments, tinkling with a silvery sound responsive to the inaudible music of their gleesome spirits. Some youths and maidens were of soberer garb, yet well maintained their places in the irregular throng by the expression of wild revelry upon their features. Such were the colonists of Merrymount, as they stood in the broad smile of sunset round their venerated maypole. Had a wanderer, bewildered in the melancholy forest, heard their mirth and stolen a half-affrighted glance, he might have fancied them the crew of Comus, some already transformed to brutes, some midway between man and beast, and the others rioting in the flow of tipsy jollity that foreran the change. But a band of Puritans, who watched the scene, invisible themselves, compared the masks to those devils and ruined souls with whom their superstition peopled the black wilderness. Within the ring of monsters appeared the two airiest forms that had ever trodden on any more solid footing than a purple and golden cloud. One was a youth in glistening apparel with a scarf of the rainbow patterned crosswise on his breast. His right hand held a gilded staff, the ensign of high dignity among the revelers, and his left grasped the slender fingers of a fair maiden, not less gaily decorated than himself. Bright roses glowed in contrast with the dark and glossy curls of each, and were scattered round their feet, or had sprung up spontaneously there. Behind this lightsome couple, so close to the maypole that its boughs shaded his jovial face, stood the figure of an English priest, canonically dressed yet decked with flowers, in heathen fashion, and wearing a chaplet of the native vine leaves. By the riot of his rolling eye and the pagan decorations of his holy garb, he seemed the wildest monster there, and the very comus of the crew. "Votaries of the maypole," cried the flower-decked priest, "merrily all day long have the woods echoed to your mirth. But be this your merriest hour, my hearts. Lo, here stand the Lord and Lady of the May, whom I, a clerk of Oxford, and a high priest of Merrymount, am presently to join in holy matrimony. Up with your nimble spirits, ye morris dancers, green men and glee maidens, bears and wolves and horned gentlemen. Come, a chorus now, rich with the old mirth of Merry England, and the wilder glee of this fresh forest. And then a dance to show the youthful pair what life is made of and how airily they should go through it. All ye that love the maypole, lend your voices to the nuptial song of the Lord and Lady of the May." This wedlock was more serious than most affairs of Merrymount, where jest and delusion, trick and fantasy kept up a continual carnival. The Lord and Lady of the May, though their titles must be laid down at sunset, were really and truly to be partners for the dance of life, beginning the measure that same bright eve. The wreath of roses that hung from the lowest tree bough of the maypole had been twined for them and would be thrown over their heads in symbol of their flowery union. When the priest had spoken, therefore, a riotous uproar burst from the rout of monstrous figures. "Begin you the stave, reverend sir," cried they all, "and never did the woods ring to such a merry peal as we of the maypole shall send up." Immediately a prelude of pipe, cithern, and viol, touched with practice minstrelsy, began to play from a neighboring thicket in such a mirthful cadence that the boughs of the maypole quivered to the sound. But the maylord, he of the gilded staff, chancing to look into his lady's eyes, was wonderstruck at the almost pensive glance that met his own. "Edith, sweet lady of the May," whispered he reproachfully, "is yon wreath of roses a garland to hang above our graves, that you look so sad? Oh, Edith, this is our golden time. Tarnish it not by any pensive shadow of the mind, for it may be that nothing of futurity will be brighter than the mere remembrance of what is now passing." "That was the very thought that saddened me. How came it in your mind, too?" said Edith, in a still lower tone than he, for it was high treason to be sad at Merrymount. "Therefore do I sigh amid this festive music. And besides, dear Edgar, I struggle as with a dream and fancy that these shapes of our jovial friends are visionary in their mirth and real, and that we are no true Lord and Lady of the May. What is the mystery in my heart?" Just then, as if a spell had loosened them, down came a little shower of withering rose leaves from the maypole. Alas for the young lovers! No sooner had their hearts glowed with real passion than they were sensible of something vague and unsubstantial in their former pleasures, and felt a dreary presentiment of inevitable change. From the moment that they truly loved, they had subjected themselves to earth's doom of care and sorrow, and troubled joy, and had no more a home at Merrymount. That was Edith's mystery. Now leave we the priest to marry them, and the maskers to sport round the maypole till the last sunbeam be withdrawn from its summit, and the shadows of the forest mingle gloomily in the dance. Meanwhile, we may discover who these gay people were. 200 years ago and more, the old world and its inhabitants became mutually weary of each other. Men voyaged by thousands to the west, some to barter glass beads and such like jewels for the furs of the Indian hunter, some to conquer virgin empires, and one stern band to pray. But none of these motives had much weight with the colonists of Merrymount. Their leaders were men who had sported so long with life that when thought and wisdom came, even these unwelcome guests were led astray by the crowd of vanities which they should have put to flight. Erring thought and perverted wisdom were made to put on masks and play the fool. The men of whom we speak, after losing the heart's fresh gaiety, imagined a wild philosophy of pleasure, and came hither to act out their latest daydream. They gathered followers from all that giddy tribe, whose life is like the festal days of soberer men. In their train were minstrels, not unknown in London streets, wandering players whose theatres had been the halls of noblemen, mummers, rope dancers, and mountebanks, who would long be missed at wakes, church ales, and fairs. In a word, mirth-makers of every sort, such as abounded in that age, but now began to be discountenanced by the rapid growth of Puritanism. Light had their footsteps been on land, and as lightly they came across the sea. Many had been maddened by their previous troubles into a gay despair. Others were as madly gay in the flush of youth, like the May Lord and his lady. But whatever might be the quality of their mirth, old and young were gay at Merrymount. The young deemed themselves happy. The elder spirits, if they knew that mirth was but the counterfeit of happiness, yet followed the false shadow willfully, because at least her garments glittered brightest. Sworn triflers of a lifetime, they would not venture among the sober truths of life, not even to be truly blessed. All the hereditary pastimes of old England were transplanted hither. The King of Christmas was duly crowned, and the Lord of Misrule bore potent sway. On the eve of St. John, they felled whole acres of the forest to make bonfires, and danced by the blaze all night, crowned with garlands, and throwing flowers into the flame. At harvest time, though their crop was of the smallest, they made an image with the sheaves of Indian corn, and wreathed it with autumnal garlands, and bore it home triumphantly. But what chiefly characterized the colonists of Merrymount was their veneration for the maypole. It has made their true history a poet's tale. Spring decked the hollowed emblem with young blossoms and fresh green boughs. Summer brought roses of the deep blush and the perfected foliage of the forest. Autumn enriched it with that red and yellow gorgeousness which converts each wildwood leaf into a painted flower. And winter silvered it with sleet and hung it round with icicles till it flashed in the cold sunshine, itself a frozen sunbeam. Thus each alternate season did homage to the maypole, and paid it a tribute of its own richest splendor. Its votaries danced round it once at least in every month. Sometimes they called it their religion or their altar, but always it was the banner staff of Merrymount. Unfortunately, there were men in the New World of a sterner faith than these maypole worshippers. Not far from Merrymount was a settlement of Puritans, most dismal wretches, who said their prayers before daylight, and then rot in the forest or the cornfield till evening made it prayer time again. Their weapons were always at hand to shoot down the straggling savage. When they met in conclave, it was never to keep up the old English mirth, but to hear sermons 3 hours long, or to proclaim bounties on the heads of wolves and the scalps of Indians. Their festivals were fast days, and their chief pastime the singing of psalms. Woe to the youth or maiden who did but dream of a dance. The selectmen nodded to the constable, and there sat the light-heeled reprobate in the stocks, or if he danced, it was round the whipping post, which might be termed the Puritan maypole. A party of these grim Puritans, toiling through the difficult woods, each with a horseload of iron armor to burden his footsteps, would sometimes draw near the sunny precincts of Merrymount. There were the silken colonists sporting round their maypole, perhaps teaching a bear to dance, or striving to communicate their mirth to the grave Indian, or masquerading in the skins of deer and wolves, which they had hunted for that special purpose. Often the whole colony were playing at blind man's buff, magistrates and all, with their eyes bandaged, except a single scapegoat, whom the blinded sinners pursued by the tinkling of the bells at his garments. Once, it is said, they were seen following a flower-decked corpse, with merriment and festive music, to the grave. But did the dead man laugh? In their quietest times they sang ballads and told tales for the edification of their pious visitors, or perplexed them with juggling tricks, or grinned at them through horse collars, And when sport itself grew wearisome, they made game of their own stupidity and began a yawning match. At the very least of these enormities, the men of iron shook their heads and frowned so darkly that the revelers looked up, imagining that a momentary cloud had overcast the sunshine, which was to be perpetual there. On the other hand, the Puritans affirmed that, when a psalm was pealing from their place of worship, the echo which the forest sent back seemed often like the chorus of a jolly catch, closing with a roar of laughter. Who but the fiend and his bondslaves, the crew of Merrymount, had thus disturbed them? In due time a feud arose, stern and bitter on one side, and as serious on the other as anything could be among such light spirits as had sworn allegiance to the Maypole. The future complexion of New England was involved in this important quarrel. Should the grisly saints establish their jurisdiction over the gay sinners, then would their spirits darken all the clime and make it a land of clouded visages, of hard toil, of sermon and psalm forever. But should the banner staff of Merrymount be fortunate, sunshine would break upon the hills, and flowers would beautify the forest, and late posterity do homage to the Maypole. After these authentic passages from history, we return to the nuptials of the Lord and Lady of the May. Alas, we have delayed too long and must darken our tale too suddenly. As we glance again at the Maypole, a solitary sunbeam is fading from the summit and leaves only a faint golden tinge blended with the hues of the rainbow banner. Even that dim light is now withdrawn, relinquishing the whole domain of Merrymount to the evening gloom, which has rushed so instantaneously from the black surrounding woods. But some of these black shadows have rushed forth in human shape. Yes, with the setting sun, the last day of mirth has passed from Merrymount. The ring of gay maskers was disordered and broken. The stag lowered his antlers in dismay. The wolf grew weaker than a lamb. The bells of the Morris dancers tinkled with tremulous affright. The Puritans had played a characteristic part in the Maypole mummeries. Their darksome figures were intermixed with the wild shapes of their foes, and made the scene a picture of the moment when waking thoughts start up amid the scattered fantasies of a dream. The leader of the hostile party stood in the center of the circle, while the rout of monsters cowered around him like evil spirits in the presence of a dread magician. No fantastic foolery could look him in the face. So stern was the energy of his aspect that the whole man, visage, frame, and soul, seemed wrought of iron, gifted with life and thought, yet all of one substance with his headpiece and breastplate. It was the Puritan of Puritans. It was Endicott himself. "Stand off, priest of Baal," said he, with a grim frown, and laying no reverent hand upon the surplice. "I know thee, Blackstone, thou art the man who couldst not abide the rule even of thine own corrupted church, and hast come hither to preach iniquity, and to give example of it in thy life. But now shall it be seen that the Lord hath sanctified this wilderness for his peculiar people. Woe unto them that would defile it, and first for this flower-decked abomination, the altar of thy worship." And with his keen sword, Endicott assaulted the hollowed maypole. Nor long did it resist his arm. It groaned with a dismal sound. It showered leaves and rosebuds upon the remorseless enthusiast. And finally, with all its green boughs and ribbons and flowers, symbolic of departed pleasures, down fell the banner staff of Merrymount. As it sank, tradition says, the evening sky grew darker, and the woods threw forth a more somber shadow. "There," cried Endicott, looking triumphantly on his work, "there lies the only maypole in New England. The thought is strong within me that, by its fall, is shadowed forth the fate of light and idle mirthmakers amongst us and our posterity. Amen," saith John Endicott. "Amen," echoed his followers. But the votaries of the Maypole gave one groan for their idol. At the sound, the Puritan leader glanced at the crew of Comus, each a figure of broad mirth, yet at this moment strangely expressive of sorrow and dismay. "Valiant captain," quoth Peter Palfrey, the ancient of the band, "what order shall be taken with the prisoners?" "I thought not to repent me of cutting down a maypole," replied Endicott, "yet now I could find in my heart to plant it again, and give each of these bestial pagans one other dance around their idol. It would have served rarely for a whipping post." "But there are pine trees in now," suggested the lieutenant.
"True, good ancient," said the leader.
"Wherefore, bind the heathen crew, and bestow on them a small matter of stripes apiece, as earnest of our future justice. Set some of the rogues in the stocks to rest themselves, so soon as Providence shall bring us to one of our own well-ordered settlements, where such accommodations may be found. Further penalties, such as branding and cropping of ears, shall be thought of hereafter."
"How many stripes for the priest?" inquired ancient Palfrey.
"None as yet," answered Endicott, bending his iron frown upon the culprit. "It must be for the great and general court to determine whether stripes and long imprisonment and other grievous penalty may atone for his transgressions. Let him look to himself. For such as violate our civil order, it may be permitted us to show mercy. But woe to the wretch that troubleth our religion."
"And this dancing bear," resumed the officer, "must he share the stripes of his fellows?"
"Shoot him through the head," said the energetic Puritan. "I suspect witchcraft in the beast."
"Here be a couple of shining ones," continued Peter Palfrey, pointing his weapon at the Lord and Lady of the May. "They seem to be of high station among these misdoers. Methinks their dignity will not be fitted with less than a double share of stripes."
Endicott raised his sword and closely surveyed the dress and aspect of the hapless pair. There they stood, pale, downcast, and apprehensive. Yet there was an air of mutual support and of pure affection, seeking aid and giving it, that showed them to be man and wife, with the sanction of a priest upon their love. The youth, in the peril of the moment, had dropped his gilded staff and thrown his arm about the Lady of the May, who leaned against his breast too lightly to burden him, but with weight enough to express that their destinies were linked together for good or evil. They looked first at each other and then into the grim captain's face. There they stood in the first hour of wedlock, while the idle pleasures of which their companions were the emblems had given place to the sternest cares of life personified by the dark Puritans. But never had their youthful beauty seemed so pure and high as when its glow was chastened by adversity.
"Youth," said Endicott, "ye stand in an evil case, thou and thy maiden wife. Make ready presently, for I am minded that ye shall both have a token to remember your wedding day."
"Stern man," cried the May Lord, "how can I move thee? Were the means at hand, I would resist to the death. Being powerless, I entreat. Do with me as thou wilt, but let Edith go untouched."
"Not so," replied the immitigable zealot.
"We are not wont to show an idle courtesy to that sex, which requireth the stricter discipline. What sayest thou, maid? Shall thy silken bridegroom suffer thy share of the penalty, besides his own?"
"Be it death," said Edith, "and lay it all on me."
Truly, as Endicott had said, the poor lover stood in a woeful case. Their foes were triumphant, their friends captive and abased, their home desolate, the benighted wilderness around them, and a rigorous destiny in the shape of the Puritan leader, their only guide. Yet the deepening twilight could not altogether conceal that the Iron Man was softened. He smiled at the fair spectacle of early love. He almost sighed for the inevitable blight of early hopes.
"The troubles of life have come hastily on this young couple," observed Endicott. "We will see how they comport themselves and under their present trials ere we burden them with greater. If among the spoil there be any garments of a more decent fashion, let them be put upon this Maylord and his lady, instead of their glistening vanities. Look to it, some of you."
"And shall not the youth's hair be cut?" asked Peter Palfrey, looking with abhorrence at the lovelock and long glossy curls of the young man.
"Crop it forthwith, and that in the true pumpkin-shell fashion," answered the captain.
"Then bring them along with us, but more gently than their fellows.
There be qualities in the youth which may make him valiant to fight, and sober to toil, and pious to pray. And in the maiden that may fit her to become a mother in our Israel, bringing up babies in better nurture than her own hath been. Nor think ye, young ones, that they are the happiest, even in our lifetime of a moment, who misspend it dancing round a maypole. And Endicott, the severest Puritan of all who laid the rock foundation of New England, lifted the wreath of roses from the ruin of the maypole, and threw it with his own gauntleted hand over the heads of the Lord and Lady of the May. It was a deed of prophecy. As the moral gloom of the world overpowers all systematic gaiety, even so was their home of wild mirth made desolate amid the sad forest. They returned to it no more, but as their flowery garland was wreathed of the brightest roses that had grown there, so in the tie that united them were intertwined all the purest and best of their early joys. They went heavenward, supporting each other along the difficult path which it was their lot to tread, and never wasted one regretful thought on the vanities of Marymount.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's profcj.org.